Welcome back to the Autoblog Podcast. I'm Greg Migliori. Joining me today on the phones, West Coast editor James Ryswick. How you doing?
Very good. Very good. No complaints.
Right. Cool. Sounds good. We have a great show for you guys out there. We're going to run through some of the things we've been driving. I just got out of the BMW M2 competition. That was a lot of fun. James drove one about a year ago. So we're going to talk about that, sort of about the sports coupe segment. A little bit of a hot rod, I think. Muscle car, muscle coupe. James was in the Toyota RAV4 Prime. I was in the Toyota RAV4, not the Prime, but about a year ago as well. So we'll hopscotch through those. And then he was in the Honda Odyssey recently, which is good. We both have kids. Minivans work out great for that. So we'll talk about that. Then we're going to run through just some kind of quick hits in the news segment. James had a Yakima roof rack on his, was it your Outback? Is that what it was on?
Oh, I put it on three different things.
Three different things. All right. Well, that's a segment right there. Oh, yeah. And then we'll hit some other news items. We'll see what we get to. But yeah, let's jump right in. BMW M2. I had a lot of fun with this thing. It's kind of subtle, I thought. Cool looking car. Had the big spoke wheels. A little bit of a sleeper car. After I drove the 718 Cayman T last weekend, everybody notices a red Porsche. When you're in kind of just this more stealthy two-door BMW, people don't necessarily maybe take note of that as much. It's a pretty fun car, I think. It felt very, like I said earlier, kind of a muscle coupe sort of thing. 3-liter inline six cylinder, we're looking at 405 horsepower, so that's a lot of power for, you know, a car that's pretty small, to be honest. 0 to 60, it looks like they cite 4.2 seconds. I'd agree with that. I think it's definitely sort of like your personal performance car. Steering was good. It felt, you know, it's pretty low to the ground, pretty tight. I was able to seek out some twisty roads around here and have some fun on a, you know, Sunday afternoon. When I put that in my reviews, many of them have Sunday afternoon drives in them. That's when I really have a chance to actually go out, find the route that I take, and, you know, actually put these cars through their paces, as the cliche goes. But it was a fun car, I think. You know, the trunk is, there's a little bit of a trunk which is more capable than, say, you know, again, the 718T, which is, you know, obviously a mid-engine sports car. But, the M2 has been around for a while, too. It's like the successor, if you will, to the 1 Series M, which I thought was really a sharp car. It was very precise. It was maybe even a little severe. It seemed like all the ones that came through the press fleet were bright orange, this like burst orange sort of thing. So those things were pretty wild. I think it's not the right car for everybody, but it's definitely a good sports coupe to kind of really sum it up. Interior is nice, but a little bland, if you will. But again, maybe that's not why you buy this thing. You buy it because you want a sports car with a trunk, with a back seat, but still you get that rear wheel drive performance and a lot of horsepower. You drove one about a year ago, you mentioned. What did you do with it? What do you think of this thing?
Well, you know, this car is interesting because, you know, if I think I don't really remember it all that much, and my kind of overall impression in my brain is kind of meh. I didn't really like love it as much as I was expecting to, largely because I did love that 1M so much. That was an extremely memorable car. I love the 135i. That was such a brilliant kind of lightweight feeling, playful car with a ton of like power and torque. That's just one of my all-time favorite cars. And this one, I was kind of hoping would be turned up to 11 or 14, but I just doesn't leave that impression to me. However, I look back at my driving notes from that day, because I had to pull it up, and it's just filled with superlatives. I like the snarly, sharp, nasty exhaust note, that there was no BS pops or barks. Pretty authentic. I even liked the paddle, the feel of the paddle shifters and the stub shifters. It kind of has a mechanical feel to it. Lots of good comments about the steering and then the handling. And yet I don't seem to really remember it that fondly. And I think it's because it's so, yes, it's incredibly capable, and it certainly achieves some of the driving engagement that BMW has lost in recent years, but it's still not quite back. It's not as playful as the old one, even if it is more refined and more powerful. I also think the fact that, yes, I like the feeling of the paddles, but I really want a manual in a car like this. Sorry, I know I'm sitting in a 22-year-old small BMW as we're recording this with a manual transmission, so this is a bit old man yelling at cloud, but sorry, it just like a small sporty sports car that isn't something you're just buying to destroy a track, because you could probably find something that's faster and better suited to that. I don't know. It's interesting because my notes say one thing, and yet my memory, it just didn't leave as impeccable or of indelible impression as you think it would. I don't know if what that says, but yeah, it is what it is.
It could say that your memory's getting a little foggy. I don't know.
I kind of felt it immediately after, I will say. You know, there are cars like a 1M and the 135. It would, back when I worked at Edmunds, we had a long-term 135. I couldn't drive that car enough. I loved it so much. It's one that it would be a car that I would buy to this day. It was just so fun and a bit of a throwback. This one isn't as much. Maybe it's just, it doesn't live up to a successor in my brain, but nevertheless.
It's interesting when you say that, because I've had a good time driving this car. I have driven the M2 before. It's actually been around for a few years. They did a light update a little while ago. I vividly remember driving the 1 Series M when I was at Auto Week. It's stuck in my brain. I remember that evening. Couldn't tell you the last time I drove an M2 before this, which, like I said, I'm sure they've come through the fleet recently. I was going through some of the BMW media literature, if you will, and they're like trying to draw the line to a turbo 2002, which is really trying to like connect the dots of history there throughout their lineage, which is, I mean, I get what they're trying to do, but, this car to me also, while enjoyable, still feels very commoditized. You know, it's sanitized in a way, if you will, but it's still a lot of fun. I mean, when I'm looking at different options for this kind of money and in this segment, you know, there's a variety of things. You know, this one was priced, I don't have the sticker in front of me, it's probably back in the glove box, but I mean, it's like you could get a pretty good Mustang for this price point, you know, even different Caymans and Boxsters, you know, if you want to basically get a very like basic one of those, you know, one of those, but still get that mid-engine layout and not a ton of power. I mean, there's a lot of different things you could do if you have this kind of money to play with. And I think this is a viable option. I'll say that.
Yeah, it starts at, well, sorry, the 2019s that I'm looking at here started at 58.9. The one, yeah, I had 60 was 67,000 because it had the M driver's package and the DCT in it. As well as the executive package with a heated steering wheel and wireless charging and things like that. So yeah, like a Cayman. The other thing is the Supra.
Yeah.
This car is related to the Supra because the Toyota and BMW engineers who built the Z4 Supra new platform basically like used a 2 Series as the source of those initial like parts. They took it apart and generally used the parts bin from a 2 Series in that endeavor. And the Supra is a sensational driver's car. I think I kind of enjoy driving the Supra a little more. That left more of an impression to me. Although, again, according to my notes, I preferred the steering on the BMW in certain, in like tighter, twistier bits, because it doesn't have the variable assist to the same extent as the Super does. And here's the other thing. Although the two are related, this thing has a back seat. And I like the Super a lot, but it doesn't have a back seat. And as my two-seater car here gathers dust as I've gained a third member of my family, I can appreciate why people would kind of like a back seat, even if it's nominally useful.
I didn't look too closely. I believe there may have been latch seats in the back if you want to, you know, get a car seat back there. I did
put... it has to.
Yeah, I mean, I got my kid in an X2, which is about the same size, different segment, but so it's doable if you need to do it. Mm-hmm. I considered it this last weekend with this car. We have this cider mill that's about 40 miles away, and I thought, oh, that'd be kind of a fun drive. Take the kid out there, and it rained. It wasn't, like, worth doing. But yeah, I mean, a backseat is definitely a thing to consider when you're looking at this segment. Like, what are you going to do with it? You know, are you going to actually daily drive it in some ways, or you're not, you know, and how many people are in your, you know, your family, all those things.
Mm-hmm. Well, even just if it's just two people, like having a backseat of any, like even like a Lexus LCs or 911s, like those are just glorified shelves.
Yeah.
But, like, that makes a difference because you can just pop a small bag over your shoulder when you're on some road trip. You don't have to put it at whoever's sitting in the passenger seat's feet or get out and grab it in the trunk or, you know, it's funny how, like, we note how, yeah, useless back seat, but having something back there is actually helpful.
Well, I know there's I'm going to date myself here, but there's a line in a Counting Crows song about how dreams are like movies and memories are films about ghosts. And I think that applies to a couple of these sporting coupes from BMW that we're talking about, more aptly to the 1 Series M, which we both are looking at with rose-colored glasses, maybe a little bit with the M2. So, you know, it's a fun car that's got a long history to live up to, and it does have a back seat, which probably is a good transition to the Honda Odyssey that has plenty of seats. I'm a big fan of the Odyssey. I haven't driven this exact, like, refresh, if you will, but what did you do with this thing?
Well, actually, the rare instance when I didn't just, you know, do a standardized drive loop in a car, I actually used it. I used it. I put my infant son and I had my parents with us, and my wife came along, and we drove out to the Oregon coast.
Nice.
So, couple of things. The Odyssey, all but the base model, have the quote magic slide seats. Mm. Now, all of the vans, Pacifica and the new Sienna, on the outside, they're basically the same size, basically have the same gargantuan amount of cargo space behind the third row. Really, they differ in the second row seats. The Sienna that was just had the first drive for, has these super long sliding seats. So they go way far forward to allow you to put just longer items without needing to remove the seats. I mean, in the last Sienna, it kind of had something similar. I could put an entire treadmill back there, just moving the second row seats back. You could not do that in the Odyssey. And for the Sienna, you have lots like this indulgent, like Dikembe Mutombo amount of backseat legroom. The Odyssey does not have that. Instead, it has laterally sliding seats. Now, they do slide fore and aft, but nowhere near the Sienna. Instead, these things slide side to side. You can remove the middle bit to allow you to move those outboard seats inward, which, as all parents know, it's best to have your kid in the middle of the vehicle. So the actual latch points for the car seats are on those individual seats. You can put them outboard, you can put them inboard. So I was able to mount the infant car seat in the middle while my mother and wife sat on either side of them. No one had to sit in the third row or anything, and they still had all this room in the world. So that really, for parents of like really young kids with the car seat, I do think that the Odyssey probably makes more sense than the other two vans as they get older, perhaps the other ones start to be a little more appealing. But one thing I would say is, despite being that the Odyssey is very much a kind of like the ultimate parent gear. It's like it's akin to a stroller or an infant car seat, like really cleverly engineered stuff that's all about the kids. Because it's no longer like the big Accord to drive that it once was. The steering is very loose and not very confidence inspiring. To drive out to the coast, you're on this kind of winding highway, and it just takes a lot of like far more concentration than you would expect from a Honda, and even more than you would have in the old Sienna SE. I haven't driven the new Sienna or the Pacifica or the Kia Sedona, which actually is better than most people give it credit for. And so it just really wasn't that the lane keeping assist reared its head a lot more than you'd like, just because it's just it doesn't have that kind of sharp Honda feel that you kind of would hope for and that you get from all their other cars, even like a Pilot or a Passport. Like there's less than those. So you know, definitely not the driver's choice if you really care that much about your minivan. So even though it's like a really like amazingly clever and well-engineered glorified stroller, it doesn't really make any attempt to make mom and dad happy.
Interesting. I enjoyed driving our long-term Pacifica hybrid we had. I thought with the little extra electrical boost it gave you in certain situations, and of course the EV range, it was quite enjoyable. The steering was pretty good. Brakes were okay. I mean, even with the regen, as you said, it was a good driver's car, air quotes, for a minivan, you know.
Mm-hmm. Because the battery of the Pacifica hybrid is where the stow-and-go seats go, you have all that like heavy weight in the middle of the vehicle.
Yeah.
Which is like great for balance and driving dynamics. It makes like the shocking difference. The road holding of the Pacifica hybrid is like shockingly good.
You know, many times I would drive that thing with people, and like, you know, once you get used to that sort of dynamic of having all that kind of planted, unexpected, you know, they'd be like, "You're a maniac. Why are you driving this crazy way in like this minivan?" And it's like, well, it's kind of fun. I'm going to amuse myself here, you know, and it's a fun one. And I would share your sentiments that the Sedona is actually an underrated van. It has been quite some time since I've driven one. But it's a decent product. I think people forget that it's out there.
Yeah. I mean, no one buys it.
Yeah. I wouldn't say, but it's like 16,000 a year out there. Yeah.
But it deserved more. Like we had a long-termer of that, and I drove it like 1,000 miles up and back when I lived in California up to Oregon. And it has like long sliding seats, kind of like the Sienna. And I like the interior of that because like the Odyssey just has all like the visual appeal of like a stove or a washing machine. It's just like a slab with some buttons. But the Sedona was kind of the first minivan that tried to make it feel a little more car or SUV like. It had the full center console with the console shifter, the regular shifter on it. And even the driving experience, it just didn't throw it in your face that you're driving a minivan constantly, which is the Odyssey definitely does that. I would think if someone's looking for like a minivan and you balk at the very expensive prices really they go for, look at the Sedona, both used and new, because it deserves more attention than it gets.
The minivan segment, I think, is an underrated yet highly useful segment. Next time we need a car, I think we're going to look at minivan in some form. I don't know if we're going to actually, you know, do that, but it's just when it comes to like the sliding doors, the enormous amount of space in the back. It's just like they're better than SUVs, especially when you like need to haul people and stuff. And it really doesn't matter what age, you know, I mean, heck, I grew up in minivans. I remember being a teenager learning to drive in one at one point. And I mean, they work, you know, no matter, you know, they're people haulers, and that's what you need.
So to put the size thing into perspective, so everybody buys his largely abandoned minivans. A lot of people have for large crossovers. So something like a Hyundai Palisade, that's really big. It's very, very large. And you know, like I can fit decently enough in the third row of the Palisade. It's better than like everything but a Chevy Traverse.
Yeah.
The Odyssey is not even, it blows that thing away in terms of third row comfort. But also the space behind the third row, I was able to put almost as much stuff behind the third row of the Odyssey as I could in the entire Toyota 4Runner, which is a giant box.
Yeah.
The Palisade, by cons, I could put four suitcases in. The difference is so incredibly vast that they're almost not comparable. So, like, you are definitely sacrificing a lot by going crossover versus minivan. Now, do people really need all that much space? Even on a, you know, day trip to the coast with five people aboard, we didn't come close to filling that thing up. But it sure made it easier that we didn't have to Tetris everything together or even put down the third row. So,
I mean, tell you what, a lot of it is like mental recalibration. Like, do you really need all the off-road styling things and the four-wheel drive and your crossover when you're just running around town? No, you don't. But a minivan that maybe doesn't have that, like, you know, cool vibe, if you will, like of a 4Runner or a Tahoe or something like that, is far more capable as far as just actually putting stuff in there. I mean, it's, when I think of, we went camping for a week when my son was like less than a year. We got everything in the back of this Pacifica. I'm talking like multiple tents, like, I mean, things like every form of things you would put like a baby in, we took with us in the Pacifica, and it fit like no problem. The dog just laid down the middle and was totally comfortable. She doesn't get kind of room in any crossover or SUV.
Oh yeah, that was another neat thing about the one thing that the Sienna and the Sedona have is those long sliding seats.
Mm-hmm.
Like we could theoretically put my son in one, slide it really far forward so that he would be accessible, and then like put the other one all the way back so that the dogs can have a dog bed on the floor, and then the other one could be in the seat.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like it's the neat versatility.
Yeah. Well, since we're ragging on crossovers, why don't we talk about the RAV4 Prime? Maybe it's good, maybe it's not, but we're taking a rather ill view of the segment of crossovers in comparison to minivans. But the RAV4 Prime, which is the hybrid, if I recall, and
plug-in hybrid.
What's that? Plug-in hybrid. That's
plug-in
right.
Plug-in hybrid, yeah.
As opposed to like some sort of transformer reference. The RAV4 is growing on me. At first, I thought it looked like they straight up ripped off the Jeep Cherokee design. I was like, what's going on here? But I've driven several of them now, and not a huge fan of the interiors, but, you know, aesthetically speaking, the design, the outside, I think looks pretty good. But what does a plug-in hybrid RAV4 Prime do for you?
Well, the Prime has... Well, there's two things. One, it has 302 horsepower, and when fully charged, the battery will take the Prime will go from 0 to 60 in 5.8 seconds.
That's insane, actually.
Right, which definitely corrects the regular RAV4's issue of kind of having a pretty meh engine. Now, when the battery is depleted, it gets pretty slow. It feels more like the regular hybrid 0 to 60 is 7.8 seconds because it effectively turns into the regular hybrid when the all-electric range is depleted. EPA says it'll go 42 miles. That's more than most plug-in hybrids.
I'd sign up for that.
I got 30 out of it, but I was on my mountain drive route, so it's not really applicable to anything. But 30, even by 30, is actually like really good for a plug-in hybrid. So you also, because it's a plug-in hybrid, you're using that electric motor more. So you don't hear the engine. You have that immediate electric torque. Really fantastic to drive. I'm a big fan of the RAV4. Every version, I've now driven the Prime and the XLE Hybrid and the TRD Off-Road. I've driven all of them. And every one, I really appreciate the fact that each of them, I can just jump in and go. I like the interior of the RAV4 Hybrid. Everything's just where I would like it. I think it looks interesting enough, especially compared to like the Honda CR-V. I think the storage is useful. I'm okay with some people don't like the Toyota infotainment system. They find it kind of boring to look at or not very quick. Honestly, I've never had a problem with it. I like the simplicity of it. I appreciate that. So I've every time I've had one, this is just the latest version, and the fact that, you know, from a performance standpoint and fuel economy, that it is so good, that's also appealing. You get there's a $7,500 federal tax credit applied to it, so eventually it'll actually, when you get your tax credit, it'll end up being cheaper than the regular hybrid. So although you look at the MSRP and it's 40 to almost 50, and that looks shocking, it's not quite as bad as that. And also with 42 miles of range, I mean, if you're driving just a regular commute that most people have, you are so rarely going to be filling it up with gas. And I tell you, people noticed it. Maybe it was because it was this gorgeous shade of candy apple red. And it's definitely because, in part, because there was a plug. It was plugged into my house, and most people aren't used to seeing a RAV4 plugged in. It sure was getting attention in front of my house. Well, you know, people tend to notice all the different cars parked out front. But that one got a lot of attention, like people asking me about it. So there's interest there about it.
That's always fun, kind of a side note here, when you're driving something that people can't, like, fathom, like, what is propelling said vehicle. Like, you know, filling up our long-term Jaguar XE that was diesel and pulling up to a diesel pump. And, you know, people in front of you are like, hey, man, what are you doing? You're going to blow up your engine. Get out of here. And it's like, no, I'm supposed to be here. That's right. This small Jaguar is a diesel. And, you know, to me, that's another sort of surprise and delight feature that, you know, the RAV4 is a plug-in. And, you know, when they can, obviously slapping a nice red coat of paint on it makes it very aesthetically pleasing. You know, when you lay out the tax credit case, it's really hard not to think, you know, go with a plug-in, you know? I mean, get that electric range, 42 miles, that's nothing to, you know, sneeze at. And it's, you know, it's, to me, that's a very compelling option. I think, you know, there's not a lot of things that are like that in this space. So, you know, generally speaking, I tend to like the CR-V a little bit more than the RAV4. But I mean, there's no plug-in CR-V. So, I mean, if you're really looking to, especially like modify, you know, your lifestyle, this could be the way to go.
Yeah. And the other nice thing I like about the Prime is it doesn't completely abandon some of the other ways the RAV4 kind of changed, specifically like it still has quite a bit of ground clearance for a compact crossover. It still had like fully functional roof rails and crossbars on it. The cargo capacity, it's diminished from the regular one, but we're talking like maybe an inch or two of cargo space. And when the RAV4 was effectively kind of the same cargo space as a CR-V in terms of the actual stuff you can put into it, it's like a minimal loss. So, you know, functionally speaking, you gain a lot. It really comes down to that cost. And, you know, yeah, you have the tax credit. So as long as you have paid enough taxes to get the credit, that full amount, you just have to deal with the fact that, you know, if you buy it in January, you're not going to see that the money back for a while. But, you know, that's And then you also get stuff from this, from states as well in a lot of places.
Yeah.
And carpool access in certain states.
You're building the case right here. It's October. You know, you can sneak in your Rev 4 Prime end of year, get that tax write off, and away you go. So something that's probably not tax deductible is a Yakima roof rack that you put on multiple cars in your fleet. It looks pretty cool. How would you say this rates out?
Well, two things. One, this is the new Yakima CBX roof carrier. So they, instead of just having one premium roof carrier, one with like more advanced, easier to use attachment points, as well as like of a nicer exterior finish, they've gone with two. So one is the very sleek, gloss black roof carrier. It's called the Grand Tour. That's been out for a while. You'll probably see them around. But then this one, the CBX, is the new one. It's more angular, and it definitely looks better on more rugged things. Like I've put it on a Crosstrek, like I put it on a Subaru Outback. It didn't look as good on my 13 Audi Allroad. So just a different look. The interior space, although like the volume number is like they're basically the same, they're shaped differently. So I was able to put four like of my largest suitcases back there. That means that those no longer have to go into the trunk, and you know it opens up a ton of space. And one of the reasons I wanted to test this, kind of broaden our horizons, is just A, how often I see, I live in Portland, Oregon, so these things are very common. People go outdoors and they expand their cargo capacity in this way, either just because they're bringing more stuff or because they're going skiing and they need an enclosed space. But the other thing is the kind of say the outdoor adventure gear space, as well as the automotive space, are increasingly merging together. I was in on a Yakima press presentation about a completely different thing, and they were noting how, you know, they're increasingly seeing cars and car brands show up at, you know, outdoor trade shows. So that would normally just be tents and roof racks and canteen bottles. And then oppositely, you're seeing more outdoorsy stuff infiltrating the car world, and you're seeing them in more like the Toyota RAV4 TRD Adventure or TRD Off-Road and the Adventure trim. At an auto show, you know, you'll see kind of a marketing push in that direction, not just because it's marketing, but because people are actually like interested in both elements. So because of that, I thought I'd educate myself a little more in terms of, you know, how these roof carriers work and the different choices and the different roof rack types, because different cars have different roof rails versus raised roof rails. Some have their own crossbars. The Outback has both. It's the only thing that has roof rails that kind of come in and become their own crossbars. So on the CBX, I put it on three different vehicles, including my own, using a Yakima like roof rack system apart from the Outback. So it was just kind of neat seeing how they worked on different vehicles, seeing, you know, that my Allroad has a panoramic sunroof, which is terrible. I never would have ordered it had it not been a used car, because it just adds all this wind noise. When you have that roof rack, when you have that roof carrier up here, you hear all of it. Whereas if you close the standard sunroof shade on the Crosstrek and the Outback, it's far, far minimized. So another reason to not get a panoramic sunroof on a car.
I am curious, what is the installation time for this equipment? What are we looking at here?
Well, now that the hardest thing to go between, say I put the same roof rack, the towers and the bar, from both the Allroad and the Crosstrek both had raised rails. So this unit I have, it's called the Timberline. It can go between different cars of different widths, which is an advantage of this product, because the bar itself can adjust wider and narrower depending on where the towers are on the rack. So you can move them in between. That takes a while because you need to like measure everything and move things and fiddle a bit. But if I just, you know, took them off my all road and want to put them back later today, it'd be very quick. You just have a specialized tool. You put them on, you remember where it goes properly, and just tighten some screws. It's kind of like a 5 to 10 minute deal. Then the roof carrier on top of that, the hardest thing is it's not that heavy, but it's a giant, it's a small coffin, basically, that you have to lift on top of a vehicle. And I was actually, by totally random circumstances of vehicle scheduling, had all these wagons and tall hatchbacks. So that was easier than, say, putting it on even like a Nissan Rogue or a Toyota RAV4, or God, like if you had an Expedition or something, like bring a ladder. So that's difficult. But, you know, the actual process of putting them on, you know, Yakima makes it very easy. Like, I hadn't used one of these roof carrier in like a decade, basically. And, you know, there's this little knob that mounts inside, and you pull it off, and you just go to each of the four mounting points and turn the knob until it clicks 3 times. Go around, and the mounting points slide within it to match the precise width of the bars apart. Very easy. You know, I didn't need to read the instructions. I mean, the guy at Yakima showed me how to do it. This is the advantage of living 20 minutes away from Yakima headquarters, is you can just pop in and they'll show you how to do it. But it was definitely easy. I was able to do it by myself subsequently. So
sounds pretty civilized. I think, you know, it's a very intriguing option. The show is taking on a rather outdoorsy travel twist, which is good.
Yeah, well, we can't do any of it. You know, I guess you can go outdoorsy stuff, but
about all you can do.
Yeah.
Cool. All right, so let's run through a couple more news items. We'll kind of hit them kind of quickly here. One, this is super random, but 75% of Autoblog Twitter users preferred the Hummer over the Tesla Cybertruck, strictly on the basis of its design. You think this is just the random snapshot in time that we did, or you think the Hummer looks that much better than the Cybertruck? I'm going to go with column B, that I think the GMC Hummer is actually a pretty good looking vehicle. And I think we have a story up that Tesla is going to try to smooth out the Cybertruck. But what do you think? You don't think they're going to roll that thing out?
I think that this number has more to say about the fact that the Tesla Cybertruck is insane nonsense.
Okay.
Like, what? Like, real? Exactly. They're going to make that, really? That, yeah, that is going to pass every single government regulation and not cost an insane amount of money to do, like, no. I mean, it didn't even have real, like, tires on the thing. And although people were, like, blown away and shocked by it and possibly intrigued about the possibility of driving some sort of Blade Runner vehicle, I think the nonsensical nature of it, I think, went a little too far for people and views. And as such, the Hummer seems a little less ridiculous, even though itself is scoring quite high on the ridiculous meter. Shorter, and it's about the same length as, say, like a GMC Canyon, but it's wider than a Raptor, which is like really crazy dimensions.
Yeah.
And a Raptor is so wide, it needs the little lights on it to indicate it's such. The only truck that's going to be wider than this are dually heavy-duty pickup trucks. So good luck parking that in LA, where every single compact spot, or every single parking spot, is a compact spot. Because you know they're going to sell them a lot there. Because they did last time, too. The Hummer was back in like the early thousands, I went to Pepperdine University, which is in Malibu, California. And the two most popular IT cars at the time, you saw them everywhere, was paradoxically the Hummer and the Mini Cooper. They were everywhere. It was just the hot thing. That's just another, well, that's just an aside.
I mean, if I'm going to drop Counting Crows references, you can reference the early 2000s at Pepperdine. So by all means.
Yeah.
Rock and roll. Let's talk real quick. I bring this up not because I want to add some really boring industry news to this, but you really are into James Bond. And Aston Martin has had this, like, Mercedes, Daimler has owned kind of a small stake in them for a number of years. They have done some component sharing. Looks like they're going to bump it up to about 20% now. And it just, it seems like Mercedes keeps creeping up. Another 5% here, another 3% there. You know, I kind of wonder if at some point Daimler is just going to swallow them up and make them a sub-brand. Doesn't really seem to fit with the, like, what Daimler does to have this random brand. It seems more like almost like a Volkswagen move, if you will, to do this. But I don't know. You're like, I know you're really into James Bond. You're really into all the, like, the things that go along with it. I think I'd like to see Aston remain independent at the end of the day. But I don't think at the end of the day, you know, their future, they've been around for like 110, 107 years. Ultimately, maybe just some sort of company owning them could be good for them. I mean, because that would let them keep the lights on long term, as opposed to like the various like investors who have been sort of running them since Ford sold them off.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if, like, I don't know if they would really be swallowed by Mercedes. I don't know how much that would really make sense for either of them. I'm not entirely sure what Mercedes gets out of the deal, because I don't know how profitable Aston Martin is, but it sure makes a difference in terms of the product that we see. I mean, Aston doesn't need to invest money in new V8 engines. I mean, Mercedes is getting them that. Yep. They don't have to invest money in infotainment systems. Mercedes is giving them that. And if you're going to have those elements given to you by a car company, Mercedes, that's a pretty good choice. Kind of hard to go wrong with those. Are that's a good parts bin to pull from. Certainly better than, say, the 2006 Aston Martin DB9 and DBS and those that have a Volvo, I wouldn't call it infotainment system. I would call it whatever the in-between point between an infotainment system and a radio faceplate was, but they came from Volvo. You know, Aston Martin's used to, like, the DB7, I think it had like the door pull of a Miata. Yeah. And, you know, like, the going way back, like the early 90s one had the steering wheel of a Ford Crown Victoria. It was green, but it was still the same part. So, you know, I think there's nothing but really good things that can come from Aston, because frankly, they've barely stayed alive over the years. Like, barely. If it wasn't for James Bond, that company would be long gone. But, you know, now if they can have a real, you know, major partner that's, you know, can actually give them, it's not just a bunch of money coming to them, say, like Geely owning Lotus or something. It's getting actual, it's money and engineering know-how and parts, and, you know, it makes sense to me.
Yeah, I, like you, I don't 100% get why Daimler owns these guys. I actually asked the former CEO, Dieter Zesche, this once at a C-Class launch in Alabama. It was a pretty random press conference, but they did a presser at the factory, and we had driven the cars, and he had flown in because they had, you know, like, they were inaugurating the factory and all that. And I asked him that. I was like, hey, what do you guys get out of this? Or is this working for you? And he was kind of like, yeah, we like it. I mean, didn't really offer any more specifics. And one of the things I remember was that half the people in the room, like, because it was like wire reporters and everybody, didn't even know that they had this stake. So I think the fact that it's this sort of behind the scenes thing seems to be working. And you know, I the last few Astons I've driven, I've been pretty impressed with, you know, as far as getting the overall architecture to a more healthy place. You know, it's like you mentioned some of those like Crown Victoria references, like, oh wow, I didn't even know that. That's some amazing trivia. And that's like, but that's like when you're independent or when you're owned by somebody like Ford, that's like trying to feed all those different mouths that they were trying to feed at that point. They own Jaguar, they own Land Rover, they own Mazda. You know, Aston was never going to get, they own Volvo. Aston was never going to get the kind of, you know, attention they truly needed. But let's wrap things up here with, we'll call it sort of a spend my money. Your dad is looking for a Volvo S60. Speaking of yes, former Premier Automotive Group brands, how's the search going? Spend his money for us.
Well, here's the thing. So he doesn't want some like, he doesn't want like the bright Nordic blue one with the red interior and the like, just finding a car that is like what he wants is like has been shockingly difficult. First he wanted the T8, the plug-in hybrid, but the choices for that, there was maybe three or two in the greater Phoenix area. So, and they were both the exact same color that he didn't want and had options on them he didn't want. And he was like, okay, I'm going to look at the T5 inscription. Okay, there's one of those. All of them are T5 Momentums in the greater Phoenix area. And so it speaks to the fact that, one, build your own functionalities on websites is basically useless, because unless you want to order the car, you're never going to find what you really want, with the exception of something like the Honda, which has very few choices. And it's very frustrating for him, because it means he can't really get what he wants, but also what the company and the website kind of promised you could get. And again, this is not a Volvo issue, but it's just really frustrating. Now, you can order the car, but it's very difficult to do that. I'm going to have to find pricing that's comparable to it, and then call up the dealer, and then have them order the thing. Like, I've done it before, but it's a pain in the butt because no one really does it. And instead, they just have to rely on the vehicles that the, you know, the sales manager of the dealer thinks people will want, which is really usually just like gray cars with a black interior. Is that really that efficient for the dealers to carry all this inventory that people may or may not want? It just speaks to kind of the inefficiency of car buying in this country. And, you know, I really wish it was easier to order a car. And that, you know, kind of speaks to the advantage of the Honda system or other car companies that really reduce the amount of options and just kind of rely on trim levels to limit the number of variations that are possible. Cause it's, you're kind of like false promising otherwise. So
it can be a pain to buy a car for sure. In some ways I feel like as like automotive journalists, it's harder for us to buy a car, cause we sort of have this like idea of how we want things to work or how things should work. Or we almost know too much. We like can't accept some of these like, you know, kinks in the system, if you will. You know, I mean, what I think is interesting is, so he's in the market for a Volvo. If there was a brand that really has an opportunity to like rethink its dealer network, like they have scale, but they're not the biggest guy in the world. So it seems like Volvo is a brand that really could, you know, rethink this, you know, and smooth out the trims and just make it simpler for the customer. Mm-hmm. You know, Tesla is always going to probably be out there, you know. Then at the other end of the spectrum, you got like General Motors that has like a gazillion dealers, and they're always going to be out there too. They're probably always going to have too many dealers. So,
yeah,
you know, it's, to me, there's opportunity for a brand like Volvo. But
yeah, and it speaks to the, like, you know, he's looking for a Volvo sedan. So like the inventory is not there that it would be in another city, or in it with another vehicle type. You know, if he just wanted an XC60, I guarantee you that it would be much easier. But he still probably would have to settle for the 19-inch wheels instead of the 18s. Or be like, well, I'd rather have blue, but okay, I guess I'll get the advanced package, even though I don't want a heads-up display. Like, just stuff like that, and, you know.
What's his time frame for spending this money?
Anytime between ASAP or I think he's going to have to order the thing.
Gotcha. Okay.
He was going to get the. This is kind of why I knew of the thought on the tax credit. If you buy it in January, you don't get the tax credit for another year. But that's how that came to my attention, because he was thinking about ordering a T8, now known as the Recharge.
Right.
But yeah, he'd have to wait many, many months in order to get the tax credit. So didn't make as much sense. We'll see what he wants. He just wants a white one with a brown interior.
Sounds pretty T5 good to
inscription.
Me.
Not really. It's very similar to the long-term car that we have, but
we just had
yeah, we'll see if he can get it.
I think the S60 we have, we're getting some miles on it. Byron Hurd, one of our associate editors, took it to Maryland. Got some miles on it, so yeah, it's a nice car. I mean, I spent a good deal of time in it when we, you know, first got it, and it hasn't quite made its way back to my, you know, my house, but it's a fun long-termer. It's a good car. I think it's a good choice for what it's worth. I'm sure you guys do too. So that's all the time we have this week on the Autoblog podcast. Please send us your Spend My Monies, or we're going to keep spending our friends and relatives' money, and you know, if you want us to spend your money, that'd be great. But that's it. Please leave us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Have a great week, and we'll see you next time.